to Cataloging Cocktails. It's your honest, no BS, non-salesy conversation about data management. I'm Tim, joined by Juan. Hey, Juan.
Hey, Tim. It is always a pleasure to be in people's ears and just talk about data, talk about AI. And today I am really excited because here's a special guest that we have today. It's the first time our guest is actually from ServiceNow. Don't worry, non-salesy podcast. We're not going to talk about it. So we have Diana Wu David, who's the director of futures here at ServiceNow, or one of our colleagues. And I think we met Diana like last year when we were I was in the New York office, and we got connected and we just hit it off so quickly. And anyways, you have a fantastic background. Diana, how are you doing? Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I didn't know I was the first one, but that's okay. I no pressure. It's fine. You picked the futurist. You're like, of 30,000 people, you're like, that'd be fun. I like that. Well, that's why we get along.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, let's kick it off first with our talent toast. We are pre-recording right now and it is in our morning. But what are you drinking and what are you toasting for? What's your favorite cocktail mocktail of the moment?
Oh my gosh, I'm kind of a classic gal. I usually have Campari or soda or a Negroni, but I have to say, I'm having bad coffee out of a paper cup. That's my cocktail of the moment, and there's nothing in it. It's really coffee. I would show it to you, but I'd spill it all over my keyboard. So how about you guys?
Well, you know what? I said this in the last episode we recorded, that I just got Campari this weekend, and I'm like, it's something that I actually never have. I don't think I've ever had Campari in my house. I get Negronis or stuff, but I'm like, I need to have this, and I'm really enjoying just figuring out how to go mix it up with different things.
I'm gonna take you to a place. There's a place in New York that has amazing Negronis. So next time you're in town.
All right, I'm looking forward to that. Tim, how about you?
And just to comment real quick, I'm actually surprised that we've done this for almost 6 years now and Juan has not had Campari in his bar.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
we'll fix that.
It just goes to show how many different cocktails you can make even without it. I'll make one addition to, like, if you want to make a Campari, like, one thing that I found recently was Hendrix has, they do these, like, different curiosities where they're, like, different kinds of gins. One of them is called Hendrix Oasium, which has a very kind of citrusy taste to it, almost like an orange flavor, and that actually goes really good with a Negroni. So that's my little tidbit.
Ooh, okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's kick it off. AI, obviously AI is everywhere, but what honest, no BS, AI and human and AI collaboration, like that's one of your topics right now. What's on your mind? Tell us more.
I feel like we talk a lot about agents and we don't talk almost at all about human agency. And that is what's on my mind. I think a lot of people are just so tired of hearing new tools and new tech. And, you know, I was at the Google Cloud conference this week and it was all about adoption rates. And like, there's all this momentum, but it has nothing to do with us and human agency. That's what's on my mind.
So
I'm a little cranky. To be honest,
this is good because actually I was also at 2 weeks ago, I was at TED, and this was actually my personal takeaway was like, everybody's talking about AI, but what was interesting is that I felt that there are other talks and conversations about people realizing, no, AI is the way we can now leverage AI to help us rediscover and refine our humanity. And I think that that's one of the stuff is that kind of the pendulum is swinging so much on one side, and we realize that it is amazing technology and it's going to change the world and we're going to find cures for cancer and all that stuff for sure. But there's a moment that we're kind of disconnecting from ourselves, and we should actually can use this technology ourselves to help rediscover and find our humanity and find our human agency around this. So I'm curious, when you're talking to so many people, customers, and like how are they seeing themselves like finding this balance of human and AI, or you think that they're still stuck with AI and you're the one who's like, hey, come on, calm down, humans are here too.
You just basically encapsulated my keynote for the last 3 years. There's humans here too. Or like, you know, in the past there was it's the economy, stupid. And I was like, it's the people. And a lot of that was in the early days though. I mean, my keynote evolved to say like the early days were all about tech and really tech led. Like we were so excited it was the shiny robot, take me to the fridge. You know, we had all this superpower. We didn't really know what to do with it. We were so in love with it. So we just used it for everything. Some people in highly regulated industries would use it for small pilots, sandboxed. And other people, you know, and then all their employees would use it at home on corporate data. So I feel like we've moved beyond that because it, you know, as you see in the headlines, like there wasn't a lot of return on that. And now we're into the, oh, let's use it in embedded workflows. And it's becoming really like a big meaty thing that enterprises, almost every single enterprise is doing something. Or at least saying they are. Sometimes it's just like, we gave everybody Copilot. I worked with somebody who said that they wanted to do AI enablement, and they brought me in to talk about AI strategy and kind of the big picture. And I said, how many people actually have access to AI? And they were like, well, you know, just like a ring-fenced group of people that we feel really needs it. And so I was like, so I'm talking about AI enablement to all these people who don't actually have access to any of it. And they were like, they'll get access later. So
did you at least get them feeling a lot of FOMO? Like, were they very excited?
I guess that was my job.
Where's my AI?
That's one way to enable, I guess, is to like say, it's going to be great, you know. And so, yeah, there at the moment, there used to be, you know, even a couple of years ago, you'd see like often just, you know, like WeBank in Hong Kong, where I was, they were way ahead. And then you'd have another big bulge bracket bank that had like five people, you know, ring fence that were allowed to touch it, the technology. But now everybody is using it in some way or another. And now it's this kind of, oh, wait a minute. This is going to change the way human beings work a lot. It's massively going to change the way governance works. And so I think we're at this moment where people, leaders in big companies, but also individuals are saying, wow, this is really going to change. We really need to redesign work. We can't just give everybody Copilot and hope for the best.
Yeah, it's not just a here's your word processor or here's your tool and you know, just figure it out. What do you think is the way that companies that are really leading around this sort of human centered or human driven approach, like what are they doing? What are they thinking? And what are you encouraging them to do? Like what is kind of the right way?
And also, what are they not doing? Mm-hmm.
The people who are doing it right, what are they not doing? What are they doing? I would say that if you have people at a high level who are thinking about it holistically, and this is just my perspective because I do strategic foresight and I have been a P&L executive, so I didn't come out of like, you know, branding to become a futurist. I came out of like bog standard, boring, you know, like let's make our numbers world, restructuring, going to print sites at 2 a.m., like channel management. So just for context, I do think that people are at the boards and C-suite level, and really even at the team level, they're going, okay, what is the like fundamental value that we want to provide to people? And how are we going to reorganize across humans and technology to deliver that in the best possible way? What are, you know, the class of decisions that should belong to machines? What are the class of decisions that stay human? What are the decision rights? But before all that, the things they do right are really thinking like at a fundamental level, like why do we exist as a function or a company, or, you know, and what does that look like in the future? And so when I was working with my client NBA, the Basketball Association, they were responding to COVID and they were like, well, who are we if we're not on the courts? You know, we have not only being on the court and merchandising, and then they had this huge youth program. That was something that you know, they had to fundamentally think about, like, we're here to promote the love of basketball. We could do that in digital games. doesn't have to be on the court. So some of those conversations I see them doing really well.
You know what, these are the moments when you have to like ask yourself like, what are our values? And I just put it here, like, what is the fundamental value we want to provide to people? And I think sometimes we're kind of like on autopilot, and then this is like a moment that we have, an opportunity we have to run it like, hey, let's stop right now. Let's rethink this, because like, if we keep going on autopilot and we just bolt on this technology, are we actually going to keep doing the same thing and we're just going to do it faster? Is that really what we want to go do? Or is this an opportunity to really rethink about things? And I think this is where I'm seeing a lot of companies thinking about when they look at like, oh, we need to look at our business processes and we want to be able to understand how agents can come in and change things. Well, this is where you have to really sit down today and figure out, this is how we do things. This is our process today. And is there something we can, do we even need this process? Can we shorten this process? Like, do we need all these people in this process? Like, how do we streamline this? And I'm wondering, how much are you seeing companies like actually going through that process right now of saying, let's actually we need to understand where we are today before we actually going to go figure out what we're going to go change. Are you seeing companies starting to have that process? And if so, how are they actually doing that? Because it's like, it's easy to start talking like, oh yes, we should keep track of our processes and figure out what works and what doesn't work. But how do you actually do that?
Well, I think that there are often like C-level conversations where they're thinking about, okay, what do we want to be in the future? Like, you know, I've had many of those conversations with people where they are thinking, like, I think of it in this way, you know, business as usual, you know, generally for Foresight, you think about like, if you just have business as usual, you kind of know what the plausible or probable future is. You're just going to keep going. It's going to, you know, maybe something will knock you off or maybe something will lift you up accidentally, but you're just basically going to keep on going. The issue that I usually try to deal with is think about like, how do you take a little elevator up to something that's much more exponential? And what could that look like? And having those conversations about what that could look like frees people up from the now, which is often like, how do we tweak this one process to make it faster so we can deliver customer service, you know, at a cheaper rate because we have fewer people and it's 24/7 because an agent takes care of it and we just escalate, which is totally fair, right? That's the sort of bimodal approach of efficiency of, you know, from cost and people then leads to investment and transformative. So when you were asking what do I see people doing? Well, I guess you asked what people are not doing. What I see people doing that I don't think is a great idea, that is pretty common, is this perpetual focus on cost. Like, oh my gosh, great. We're just going to shrink and shrink and shrink. And we can do the exact same thing we do today, but with less people and, you know, more agents. And then we just stay there and everything will be fine. I don't believe that. So.
I mean, if you follow that logic, then technically we can have a fully autonomous and like no people, right? if we keep doing like, oh, we can bring in all these agents and AI and then less people, and then like, okay, we have more people. Right?
Well, there's a lot of talk about one person, you know, billion market cap companies or startups. And there's a lot of conversation. Jeremy Aoyang from Blitzscaling Ventures talks about the revenue per employee and how at an AI startup, it's like 2.5 million and your typical software startup, it's a couple hundred thousand. And so there is this, like that is efficiency. We have been driving towards efficiency for a very long time and it's served us a lot as companies. And we have been set up to make that. And to a certain extent, COVID was the first like, oh, maybe efficiency isn't the only metric. Maybe we need to think about the larger stakeholder group and building in resilience into our organizations a little bit more. But the folks that are doing it right are really thinking about it. And there are people that are doing that. Of course, the smaller your company, the easier it is because you can get five guys in a room or gals and say, what do we really want to do with our one wild and precious life at this company versus in a large company? You do have that. And you can see that because there's at the C-suite changes where, you know, at ServiceNow, we have a chief people officer that now does AI enablement and is thinking about those things. At Moderna, they have the HR and technology starting to pair. Standard Chartered has somebody who does talent and also strategy. And so it's really interesting to see how it's changing even the roles that we have to guide companies, because in this moment, we really need people who are thinking both strategically and also have the, you know, at least strategic understanding of AI. And you can see it also because there's a lot of CEOs resigning who say that they just aren't capable of shepherding their companies in this new era of transformation.
So I love this concept of like, you know, your chief people officer, your CHRO, like, are they driving both talent and strategy? Are they driving both human enablement and AI enablement, right? So it seems like leadership is one really important key to this puzzle, right? And some leaders are rising to the occasion, some are struggling. What else are you seeing as some, you know, strategies or tactics that are allowing people to go from just sort of this linear thinking, which might be like, well, let's roll out Copilot or something like that, and everybody's going to get 5% more efficient or 10% more efficient or whatever that is, right? Versus more dramatic rethinking of how things can happen. Like, have you found that like doing design workshops have been really effective? Have you, I guess, what have you seen that's been effective?
I wish we could design workshop our way to yeah.
All we need is a whiteboard, right? Yeah.
I mean, I do workshops, so I would love that, you know. And I believe in, part of the reason I love Foresight is I believe in the power of getting people into a room to imagine the future with some, you know, some scaffolding and a good facilitator, basically, you know. It comes from military. It comes from really thinking about like, what are the plausible futures? And that is a certain amount of risk mitigation, right? Like, we think about what could happen so that we could avoid the bad stuff. We spend less time thinking about what could happen so that we could optimize for the best possible option. And so, yes, I do think that oftentimes when I'm working with people, it's because we're talking about what's possible and we're getting from them, you know, or even like birthing a conversation about what's possible from all the people in the room. And then we come in to have a conversation about how technology enables that. So I do think that that is important. And, you know, one of the conversations I had with a large retailer who had multiple brands, I'd love to say it was like all AI driven, but no, it was business driven. It was, you know, a consolidation under one holding company and them really having to rethink what the customer experience was. I mean, honestly, they had to rethink how to do their technology spend and all that. But to have a framework of, okay, what about the customer? And that's one thing I see people really doing well, that are able to transform. They don't have like a million possibilities. They think about their customer and they go back from there. So for this particular one, we really spent some time thinking like, if your customer doesn't have to go to these five different companies you own, what does that look like? Let's like craft a day in the life where from dawn to dusk, they are interacting with your brand via technology in a way that is synchronous, which has never been possible before because you've always had, you know, this different fundamental structure for your company. Those are the kind of conversations we need to have, not like sprinkle the AI fairy dust and, you know, see what happens. It's like, it's pretty fundamental. Restructuring a company is no small business. And I think that's why nobody wants to even enter the conversation of like, how do we redesign what we're doing? So, you know, the other thing that I do see is taking it to smaller chunks to eat the bear or eat the frog, whatever the metaphor is.
One of my favorite.
We're a
phrases.
Team. Yeah. So, you know, you can really think about like, okay, my team's going to do this. Like one of the teams that I talked to was like, okay, we're going to have people apply to work on four projects that disrupt our work, and they get 20% time. Not everybody in that department, but just a few, and they're disrupting their own work. So that's a way to, with AI. So that's a way to do it kind of ground up and at a level, a team level. And I think that's completely possible. Eventually you have to think about the larger redesign. And then the last is just the people. Like, if you're going to transform like that, then ask people if that's working for them. Don't just think about like how many people logged in or how many people clicked, you know, how many people, what products you shipped. Think about their lived experience, because people hate work sometimes now. And, you know, rolling out like an NPS score, for instance, to say, would you recommend this transformation to your friends?
I like that.
How many people would do that?
I think that's a smart reframing of it.
I'm putting this in the lens of our listeners, right? So data folks, data leaders, executives. And one thing you said, like, center around questions like, what about the customer? I think this goes back into like the human centered aspect, right? Data goes across so many parts. Data is something that flows across every part of a business, every single business line, right? The whole data is over there. And I'd argue that unfortunately sometimes, like, because the data teams become their own silo, because they just receive data and they do things and they bring it and they just come here and then I'll just give you the report that you asked back or whatever, when they're not actually being understanding the day in the life of a particular, the day in the life of a transaction, of a piece of data that goes in through, and then what it affects and who are the people involved in all that stuff. And there's all these 5, 6, 7, 10 different systems that you have to go through. And I wonder now, like, this is actually a question I'm going to pose for the data executives and data leaders I talked to, is like, when was the last time you actually had you got into a room and you're like, let's think about the future here. You actually bring in diverse people to say, hey, how would this actually look like? And by the way, like, the technology would be the second conversation versus like, let's really think about the data life here of different personas in our organization, because at the end of the day, data is affecting everybody. I think this is something that we need more. I'm appreciating this conversation. It's opening my mind here. So.
Day in the life of, I feel like that would make a great story or great book, like a day in the life of a piece of a data, kind of like a Planet Money podcast. It's interesting because data is, you know, at a base level, you're like, we get requests, we fulfill them. Like, most of work is like that, right?
That's true.
Let me carry this little anecdote a bit further, because actually the team that was processing and got people to work on 20% time to disrupt itself was actually dealing with that. They basically our marketing team, and they were like, all we do all day is respond to people who ask us all these questions, and that, like, that's our whole job. And it's not a hugely value-added job. It's just responding to emails from people who want a certain kind of, you know, like, they want the messaging, they need to know the update it is. And so they just automated it with AI. In a way, they went out to ask people, like, how could we make this easier for you? Or, you know, what would make this something that you would use instead of emailing us? So those are the kind of conversations, I think, that, you know, that's sort of the bottoms up changes that I see in organizations. And you know, it's amazing because data right now has, like, it's the kind of the atom from which everything else is built. And it's also like super high level, you know, when you think about data sovereignty trends, fundamentally reshaping how we can do our business. So it's really, there's a lot to think about.
Let's kind of take a little bit of a turn here and go on to, you just said the data sovereignty trends. That's a topic we haven't touched here.
Really?
So what is it?
At a high level, okay. You know, data sovereignty and national sovereignty, I would say, just on a basic level, the way that I'm thinking about it is There are a lot of countries, and I lived in Asia for 20 years, so that's part of my perspective. There's a lot of countries that are thinking, I want to have my, you know, my own data, like in companies as well, but I'm thinking about it on a country level. To be reliant on them. And, you know, some of it is related to in early days, how people were training models. So they wanted their own values, they wanted their own culture, they wanted it to be local, locally kept. And you've seen that in China for a long time. And in Europe, they're very much thinking about like, how do we have local data, localized cloud service, local models, et cetera. And then you saw that with India as well, which is positioning itself to say, here, Southeast Asia, you don't have to choose between these two big superpowers and be beholden to them. We have an alternative for you. Whether or not they'll be able to play that role, I don't know. Japan also thinking about its own data. So it's something that I'm watching because, you know, that fragments the market. And most software has been gone to market as this with the idea that, you know, with cloud, that it's sort of do it once and then it scans the globe. But that completely changes if every region or every country is saying, actually, no, we want our own sovereignty. We have different regulations. There's now 140 countries with data regulations. So that's what I'm thinking about related to sovereignty, just at the national and regional level, not even at the company level.
So this, I one thought here, and then Tim, to you. So governance, talk about data governance, AI governance, all this stuff. Like, if we thought it was complicated today, wait till tomorrow, or because it's going to get. Oh, Tim, you follow. You were going to say something.
Well, I was just going to ask, like, what, you know, where do you think this is all going when we continue to get more of this fragmentation around? You know, it feels like AI is being an accelerator right now, where, you know, I think we had some, you know, regional frameworks around governance and around compliance and things like that. But now with AI, yeah, it feels like every country wants to have their nuance around, or even, you know, we've got states here in the US, right, that each kind of want to have their own nuance around what's okay, where the data could be stored, what uses, report, you know, starting to develop some frameworks on how you're going to report on what AI decisions are being made and things like that. And do you have sort of a trajectory do you see here? And is this just a reality we're going to have to grapple with and try to solve as much as we can with a sort of a human and technology collaboration?
I think it's easier at the company level and sort of the agent level, where suddenly we're making a lot of progress on understanding the risk in terms of least privilege, you know, for agents and zero trust architecture, and being able to onboard and register behavioral drift and decommission agents. So from that perspective, I think that will be helpful. And I don't think that a lot of people have kind of gone through what is becoming basic hygiene for technology governance. So once that is more embedded and standardized, I think it'll be easier to then match it to the countries who are thinking. And I do think that we need more of a global, like, basic standard for AI governance. So, you know, and part of the beauty of AI and, you know, what sometimes what we call autonomous compliance is that you can actually do compliance where you can model, you know, here's all the different things that can happen when these different governance frameworks change. And this is what we'll do in response to that. You know, there's more of that happening until compute costs get too high, and then we'll just have to calculate it by hand with a pencil.
Yeah, it's exciting, kind of, you know, that last comment steps into a little bit of, you know, I experienced this in my own work too, where we start to envision all these different ways that AI are, you know, going to apply to these different things. And then it's like, man, compute is going to be, you know, compute costs are going to be kind of a factor in, you know, in kind of in new ways where we used to spend a lot of time thinking about, like, you know, even in the software realm, how many, you know, how long is it going to take to deliver that feature? It's usually, well, like, is that going to, you know, how many humans do we need to apply to that engineering team? And how long is that going to take? Where now we have sort of new economics to things like compliance, things like governance, but also, of course, things like software and other parts of our business where, you know, how much GPU budget do you have?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's hard. I feel like we're in the appetite stage where we want all these things, and appetite is easy, but digestion is hard. Like, making something really productive out of the inputs is, you know, that's the organizational metabolism that everybody needs to shift to, from just the how much adoption can we put on the leaderboard to what's actually happening when we combine the technology with the humans, with the strategy. What do we actually produce that's valuable in the world?
Yeah.
What do you think are going to be the metrics today that people, like, we're talking about, like, adoption? Oh, how well are we doing with AI, right? Oh, we're talking about adoption metrics, right? Then, I know, tokens consumption. Like, what do you think are going to be the metrics that we should be tracking to know that we're actually getting the most value out of AI, and having that combination of a human AI collaboration that we're do we even know what those metrics could be that we should be striving for?
Well, I think it's the outcomes. It's like, what are you actually trying to deliver to your customer, right? If you think about the IKEA example, where they took a bunch of cost out because customer service deflections with AI, maybe the outcome could have been cheaper customer service, but reimagining the value to say, okay, we can retrain those people as interior designers and generate another $1 billion of value. I think that that's extraordinary. And that, you know, you'll see more of that as we go along. New value created, to me, is one of the best metrics, because it says things are growing. And that, you know, that is like the exciting opportunity we have. If everything just gets cheaper and faster and with less people, like, I don't know, that's not really the future that I'm rowing towards. But if customers and employees are delighted by the kind of opportunities that we can bring, the new things that we can do for people, be it solving the really big problems we have around climate change and disease and those kind of things, like, there's lots of work to do. If we could start making some of that stuff happen, I think that's pretty extraordinary.
You just said something I just put right here in my notes is, we can, customer service, we can reduce customer issue, the deflections, right? And so we increase the customer experience. It's going to be cheaper than the customer, but at the same, so that could be a metric, but at the same time, you're like, wait, that means that there's less people needing to go do that work. Are we retraining them? So we should also have some sort of a metric of, like, not only the customer experience, but also the employee experience too. And what's happening, because at the end of the day, like, this is kind of the big societal issue that we're seeing too. It's like, oh, AI is going to automate all this stuff, but what's going to happen with people? And at the end of the day, people, a job is not just a paycheck. Yes, we need a paycheck, but it's also a purpose. And I think this is something, and I think we are entering a world where education will be continuous, and we'll be learning new things. And then what I'm doing today is not going to be needed tomorrow, but that's okay, because we're now changed. We're learning how to adapt to learn the new thing, and that's going to be our new kind of new ways of thinking. I mean, there are jobs that 50 years ago don't exist today, right? 20 years ago don't exist today, but now those jobs that took 20 years or 50 years, like, that's going to probably happen at a much faster pace. It's like, oh, this job that we have today in a couple of years won't exist anymore, and there's a new job, and then that job is going to exist for a couple of years, then it's going to go away, and so it'll be a continuous change. I mean, that's where I think this is heading. So we need to, if that's really going to happen, technology enabled, we need to have this a human capital strategy, which I don't think we do have at this moment.
No, I wrote a book about that in 2019, actually, before the AI wave, about how work was changing. And it's called Future Proof: Reinventing Work in an Age of Acceleration. So a sort of similar idea of, you know, the work is changing, people aren't ready, companies, it was going to be for companies, and no companies were thinking about it. And it has to do with a lot of different things, not just AI. It has to do with the globalized economy. It has to do with demographics and birth rates falling in, and it has to do with technology. And so, yes, perpetual change is the new normal, and it has been for some time. And I think that that sort of is what it is, but it's not going to be a disaster, because there are some fundamental things and ground truths that people can rally around. And, you know, you see that with companies and their culture. And one of the things that you asked about in terms of return, so we talk a lot about return on investment, and companies are going, okay, great, like if I add AI and I take out all the people, my shareholders are happy and the stock goes up, and so right, return on investment is good. But, you know, also we need to think about things like return on relevance. If you gut the early in careers people, there's not going to be anybody here in 15 years to be the human in the loop to ensure the governance is going well. So, you know, return on sort of that longer term relevance of a company and their position in the market is also important. And, you know, the sort of that we still do that. We still do monitor culture. People at the board level have to say, okay, we do have a return on investment strategy for AI, but how does it affect the culture? What is our return on relevance? What is our sustainable strategy rather than just optimizing for the quarter?
Yeah, well stated. And, you know, one thing that I'll add is that I also think that in some of these conversations where companies are thinking about kind of this efficiency angle and this autonomy angle, they're not also thinking about how consumers are going to get a lot more sophisticated and powerful as well. And so that creates a whole nother dimension to what you just mentioned around return on relevance, which is that if, you know, consumers decide that your organization or your brand is not valuable to them anymore, right, it's probably going to be easier than ever to switch to a company or a brand that is relevant or that is human or whatever it is that we as a society are valuing as we go forward.
Yeah, and there is a disconnect there. And certainly, you know, we just did research on that shows that executives think all the investment in technology for their customers has been extraordinarily well received. You know, it's all good, it's going well. And customers, it's like 70% of executive or 75% of executives feel like things are going really well. And, you know, like 25% of customers feel like they have a better experience or customer experience. And, you know, that's perpetually the balance that you're trying to achieve. But really thinking about what's possible and putting customers at the center, I think. And I did actually do research on this. It's in a magazine called Global Focus with some of my colleagues at a think tank called Future Work Forum. And we just interviewed executives and said, not just AI, but like all emerging technology, quantum, you know, physical AI. And we interviewed people all around the world. And most of them said, having a focus on the customer and the problems they have, both present and the future, having a process for innovation, not just random. And it doesn't have to be the same, but like, you know, the hackathons of old and the kind of bit of discipline around innovation sprints where we decide, you know, maybe scan the horizon for what's changing, what might we offer customers or employees, what is a time-bound test or experiment we can do for that, and how do we actually do that and then measure it and decide what to keep and what to throw away, which is always the hardest part. And I think to a certain extent, that's what I think we need to be doing with our careers, is experimenting and doing that in the same way going forward.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation. We are really lucky that next week we'll get to hang out together at at the ServiceNow or Knowledge Conference. So for those listening, next week is ServiceNow Knowledge Conference. For those who are attending, we're all going to be there. So Tim, Diana, and myself. So come find us. We'll love to go chat more about this. Okay. We got our lightning round questions. So lightning round, and then we got our takeaways. All right. I got the first one here. So should the CHRO or the chief people officer co-own the AI strategy alongside, let's say, like the CTO? Yes or no?
Well, or, I think the entire C-suite team really needs to co-own, right? They all have different roles to play, and understanding which roles they play in different companies, and they'll all be different banking and, you know, whatever, yeah, theme parks or whatever. I think that's really important to say, okay, what is the ultimate goal that we're driving towards that will provide value for our stakeholders and customers? And then what roles do we need to have in the C-suite that will allow us to best accomplish that goal? And, you know, I'm sure that there are CTOs that are starting to do that, but in concert with their chief people officers and some people officers who are, like, I think those roles are blurring. So somebody needs to be accountable, but preferably the entire leadership team should be on board.
Mm-hmm. Well said. We talked about this a little bit in our chat today, but, you know, revenue per employee, wrong metric for the AI era, or is it important?
Wow, that's a really devious one. Maybe it's important, but not the only metric, because if you have just revenue per employee, and it's a tantalizing metric, particularly when you can think about employees making millions of dollars. But of course, the startups are the ones that are propagating this. Like, we have millions of dollars per employee, but they also don't have like robust governance systems. They don't have like the compliance required. They don't have the hierarchy that reduces complexity in a larger organization. And they will, and their revenue per employee will go down, but maybe after the VC exits, I don't know. So, you know, I think it's an interesting metric to think about, but we could all be fired and have one person standing for the last 3 months of the company, and that would be $1 billion per employee. So it's just an interesting metric, but not the only one. And it can be gamed like any metric.
Yeah, that's the thing. True. Are most of the needs for like human in the loop a short-term problem for the AI state of maturity, or is this inherent to how companies must operate?
Oh, wow. That's such a good question. I think that it will evolve. Certainly, Gartner put out something that said, I think it's by 2028, 25% of all agents will be guardian agents. So certainly right now we're in this transition moment where intent is important. And, you know, context graphs of like the decisions and why decisions are made and that kind of thing are just becoming a part of our, you know, workflows and data. So right now we need the human to say like, well, what we really mean is, and, you know, what that governance is. I think that that's important, but it will evolve so that there's always a human, some people call it human on the loop, like the human designing the intent or designing how things work. But there always have to be some kind of human escalation. I think that it's just, if we're designing this for the betterment of our human world, then there's got to be some humans in the sauce.
I like that. I've never heard the phrase human on the loop before. I actually like that quite a bit. And I know that even at ServiceNow, we think a little bit about like design time versus runtime, right? And how like maybe more of the runtime is being driven by AI, but there's still a lot of design time decisions that really require human taste and human touch for a while, maybe forever.
Yeah, hopefully. Because that's the fun part, right? The design time.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Final question. And then I guess last question here. Which roles, this is actually an open-ended one. Which roles in the next few years do you think are going to be the most elevated and empowered in the sort of AI realm? You know, data analyst, product manager, is it the leader? Is it the subject matter expert? Like, what's your quick take on who's going to benefit the most over the next few years here?
Maybe the investors.
That's not a CBS take right there for sure.
But I think of it more in what we need. You know, I would love to see more leaders who can be thinking more broadly about redesigning the work, because we don't have as many people doing that. And people who have the AI technical grounding that can combine that with the leadership. Because I feel like right now there's just a few kind of people who can do that. And I mean, if we don't start training some actual human beings in governance because we've gutted the employment pipeline, then, you know, the folks that are left in governance will make out like bandits from a scarcity perspective, supply demand.
All right. We got so many takeaways. Let's see how we did. Tim, take us away with takeaways.
Oh my goodness. So many takeaways. I'll try to hit just a few of my, of sort of our top points here. So we started off with, you know, honest, no BS. What do you mean? And what are we thinking about when it comes to this human plus AI collaboration? And you started off by saying, you know, we as an industry and as technologists, as humans, right? Because everybody's kind of a part of this conversation now, talking a lot about AI and the technology and about the agents, but not enough about human agency. New tools, new tech, adoption rates, right? People are like, you know, like, how much are people using the tool, right? And they used it for this and that and the other thing. But, you know, we're not talking enough about the humans. And really, it's you know, about the people. And, you know, who is, you know, actually using AI in some of these organizations sometimes is a very focused group. And what we're trying to do now is really think about how we don't just increase the adoption of AI, but actually we're looking at the broader impact of how it's helping people, how it's helping employees, how it's making an impact with customers. And we asked you about kind of what are the leaders doing and not doing. And you said that the leaders at various levels, board, C-suite, team level, they're really thinking about the question of what is the fundamental value that we want to provide people? And how do we reorganize people and process to make that happen in the right way? So it's not just about, hey, incremental improvements. It's about bigger improvements, not just to the bottom line or to the investors, but to all the humans and the stakeholders that are involved. And I thought you gave a cool example. I didn't know about this example of like the NBA. And when COVID happened, you know, they asked the question, like, who are we when we're not on the court? And I think every organization, you know, whether you're a data team all the way to, you know, you're the CEO, can be thinking about what does it mean for our organization to provide value? How do we do that? And how do we create a human and AI collaboration to really do that in the most effective way? And then we talked a lot about kind of like different strategies for affecting change, you know, getting people in the room together, the chief people officer, the CHRO driving not just sort of the talent side, but the strategy side and the AI enablement side, you know, not trying to just boil the ocean and think big, which of course you should do, but also thinking about like grounds up approaches where, you know, a small amount of folks can do, you know, targeted disruption for 20% of their week. So lots of cool ideas about how kind of at a top-down level, at a bottoms-up level, how some of this change can be affected in a really positive and impactful way. Juan, what about you? What were your big takeaways?
One thing I like that you said in this affecting change is like taking a grounds-up approach with the teams level, right? So I was saying, hey, take a small group of folks and have them say, like, how would you disrupt part of your day? I think that's a great exercise that needs to be done. And then saying, hey, if we were to do this transformation change, like, would you recommend this change to a friend or something? I think that's a really good tactic. I love that we got to this other topic about data sovereignty, which is something that we haven't talked that much of before. It's like, hey, a lot of countries are thinking like we need to have our own data. It's coming a lot from the when we're training models, we want to have trained with our own data, with our own kind of values. And Europe is doing this with local data, local cloud services, happening in India, it's happening in Japan too, which means that this starts to happen, the market's gonna get much more fragmented. So with like cloud, it's been like, oh, you do it once and you're done. But now with these changes like this, David Summerty, there's gonna be, the market's gonna be fragmented. There's gonna be so many regulations. So the question there is like, how well companies are prepared for this, right? They have governance within their own company to be able to go deal with that. And I love how you said something, a quote here I have. We have a couple of t-shirts now. We have like, these are quotes that we can put on t-shirts. Like, appetite is
excellent.
Easy. Appetite is easy, digestion is hard. So we're talking about, like, what are the metrics for these things that we discuss? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, it's all really depends on the outcomes, right? But I think kind of takeaway I had personally is, like, it's a balance between not just a shareholder value, right? Let's go, we're reducing customer issue deflection. It's going to be cheaper, better customer experience. You need less people to go do this, but we also need to have a way of retraining employees, because these things, all this is moving so fast. I mean, you wrote a book about it, Future Proof, Reinventing Work in the Age of Acceleration. And close up with, like, it's not just about ROI. Of course it's ROI, but we also need to think about this return on relevance. So if we don't have people around after a while, so what? So we need to think about AI, how it's not just impacting ROI and what's happening this quarter, but also the people and the culture. All right, how did we do?
That about sums it up. Sounds good, guys. Right. Well, done.
To wrap up, no AI. This was human connection right here, us typing and stuff. So paying attention, listening. To wrap it up, what's your advice? Who should invite next? And what resources do you follow?
You know, I had some advice, which I think was really that innovation, thinking about experimenting, reinvent, focus, collaborate. Those are the four virtues that I think really matter in this age of acceleration. But I'm going to add a fifth because of one, which is listening, because we could all get a little bit better than that, better at that. And with AI, I think that actually, because we get this, it listens to us and perpetually digests and feeds us what we want to hear. I think that listening is going to be a lost art that will really give you an advantage. And the next person or the next topic, I can recommend any of the people on my Google Next panel, Rebecca Hines from Glean, who heads up their work AI, Julia Dar is a behavioral scientist at BCG, Aishwarya Srinivasan is an AI entrepreneur and the most followed Indian woman in AI. So, gee, you have like your pick right there.
Love to make those connections.
And absolutely.
Finally, what resources do you follow?
Oh, that's kind of like my secret sauce as a futurist. But I will tell you that we are designing that in our team as signals to insight engine. And so I am giving them my top sort of 100 resources, and we will allow our internal stakeholders to play around with that and ingest tons of data and information, and then you can pick your persona, be it for data or CEO or futurist, and then we go from there. So top secret, not telling.
I love that's the honest no BS right there. Diana, thank you so much. Truly appreciate this conversation.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks so much. Take care, guys. Thank you.
You too.